get straight into the story this morning, but first just a question for you to set our minds thinking on some of these matters as we begin to kind of root the story a little bit more in our own context. I'd be interested to hear from you, and again, just a quick minute, as we would call it back home, a quick minute with a person nearby. And if you don't want to participate in a conversation at this hour of the morning, that's fine. Your neighbour will understand. But if you do, turn to your neighbour. What are the benefits, the privileges, and the responsibilities of being an American citizen? What are the privileges and what are the responsibilities of American citizenship? Turn to your neighbor and pretend like you understand the instruction.
Well, I think that in many ways.
Okay, that's a quick minute. That's our quick minute. Just and I'm not looking for any sermonizing on this. I'm just interested, as we oil the hinges of forthcoming discussion and conversation this morning, what words, phrases just come back to you without explication, and for the preachers among you, try and suppress the need. What are the privileges and what are the responsibilities of American citizenship?
Freedom of speech.
Freedom of speech.
Freedom.
Yeah, and interesting, a really interesting conversation politically and in our communities about what are the limits, if any, of speech. Yeah.
Responsibility to vote.
To vote? Oh, yeah, it's true. Just shout them out.
Responsibility of knowledge, knowing your government.
Knowledge.
Work.
Freedom of travel.
Travel. Yes, it's fun. It's very interesting when you, in order to come over here, we have a visa waiver program with Ireland. You guys have a visa waiver program, and I have to fill out a form online and submit it to your State Department, and then they give me an answer within a couple of hours. But I have to list whether I have visited certain countries in the last 6 months, and I've no idea what would happen if I tick one of those boxes. But you could probably guess which those countries are, so we travel. Yes?
It depends on who you ask.
Huh?
Do
you know, I am tempted to ask you what you mean by that? Even though I said, let's not. But give me another couple of sentences on that one.
Okay, so...
And speak in your playground voice, as we said.
So. Okay, for some of the... I'll just say Republicans. I'll just say the word. So Republicans are people far to one side of the spectrum. Your responsibility is for yourself.
It's a really interesting aspect of the formation of white American identity in this notion of individuality, of making your own way, of making, of providing for yourself and your family, and how that, and your own responsibility for decision making without the interference of others from the outside. And again, what happens when that presses up the individual freedoms of your neighbor, or the individual needs of your neighbor?
I don't think you can lay that at the feet of conservative.
No, this is your history. Yes. This is your history. This is the founding of white America, from my understanding. And okay, let's carry those with us into the conversation. And you remember, for those of you here yesterday, we finished off chapter 3 after the salacious events and the risky events of yesterday's text, in which we looked at the lengths a vulnerable woman has to go just to survive and to find a place in a foreign country. But we also flagged up, or I also flagged up, the fact that we are right in the middle now of a decision that has been made between private and personal response to need and public policy response to need. And in a brilliant and assertive way, Ruth takes responsibility to make this guy, Boaz, live up to his responsibilities, which he should have done months and months before, but he hadn't. And she makes him, you remember in chapter 2, he prays that God would shelter her. And in chapter 3, she says to him effectively, you have the means to shelter me. Don't push this away to your God. You do it. And Boaz is pressed to respond because he has it within his power. He has it within his privilege to answer the needs of this woman. But there is a limit to what he could do as an individual to meet the needs of this woman. It would be a really important and a really necessary and a really beautiful thing to address the needs of this vulnerable woman and to find a place for her. And the language of Moabite disappears in chapter 3, and the language of family is the language that dominates daughter. It's repeated again and again. So Boaz has reached this point of transition, this volta, where he turns and recognizes her not as a foreign woman, but as family. However, the limits of what he does with the privilege he has, the limits of that for her, the limits of his actions are focused on Ruth, but what about all those other vulnerable women out there in similar circumstances? It is not, and Boaz realizes, yes, I need to permanently sort Ruth's status out, but we can also make a change here that affects women in similar situations elsewhere, in the town or elsewhere. We can provide an example of generosity with the privilege that we have. And so he says at the very end of that chapter, I will sort this out tomorrow morning. Wait, my daughter, until you know how the... This is Naomi speaking to Ruth. Wait, my daughter, until you know how the matter turns out, for the man will not rest until he has settled it today. And so we're moving now from this private, and I use the phrase in my Presbyterian need to find alliteration, this pietistic, the personal response to need. They're now moving to the public policy response to the need. This is about changing the structure of the way the community acts. This is about changing a whole structure of what it is to belong to this community. What does it mean to be an American? How do you become an American? And Boaz, to go back into another context, Boaz is about to adjust the whole legal means by which you belong to this people. And this is a fascinating chapter. So let's jump straight into the story. And we'll do what we did yesterday. We'll simply work our way, stopping. I'll stop in places that I find interesting. If there's things that jump out at you, by all means, signal in some way, and we'll stop, or if there are questions that you want to ask. But this is just the text of the story. So this is the next morning after his evening with Naomi with Ruth. Remember, he sends her away with the corn wrapped up in her shawl, changing the shape of her body so that she looks pregnant almost, but won't be recognized. Meanwhile, Boaz went up to the town gate and sat down there just as the guardian redeemer he had mentioned came along. For those of you who maybe haven't been at other sessions, the town gate is like the Supreme Court of the town. This is where all the legal decisions are made. And the elders gather and they consider questions that come, and then the townspeople gather as well to hear the decisions, to enter into debate with the elders. Here's where decisions are made for the whole community. The Guardian Redeemer is a... There are a number of social protections for vulnerable people built into the law of Moses. And we encounter several of them. The main ones here in the Book of Ruth. The earliest one we found was in chapter 2, where Ruth joins all these other particularly foreign women, particularly foreign widows, who are allowed to, but also local women who have been widowed, they're allowed to follow behind the harvesters to gather up any grain that falls behind them. But also farmers are instructed not to harvest right up to the corners of the field, but to leave some there for the poor who would come behind them. If you've got olive trees, the traditional way of harvesting was to beat the olive tree, the olives fall. You're not to beat the tree exhaustively to get every single olive off it. Leave some on the trees for the poor. These are the laws of gleaning. My wife practices this back home. We have fruit bushes in the garden, and she insists that we don't harvest every fruit off the bush, but we leave some there for the wild birds in particular. I had to write out just as an aside. I'm going to mute it for when we record this. I have two raised beds in the garden that we plant. We have vegetables in one and we have fruit in the other. And we've left two of our current bushes just for the birds. But I've covered my strawberries with netting. about 10 days, two weeks or so before I came across here, I was sitting in a chair that looks out over the garden, and I noticed this tiny wren hopping along the ground and suddenly disappear. And he had found a way in under the net into the strawberries. And I sat on the chair thinking, I won't tell you exactly what word I thought. I'm going to go out there and chase that bird away. Because he obviously knew what he was doing, what she was doing, because this had been done before. And I thought, how ridiculous would it look to see a mature, middle-aged man chasing a wren away from a strawberry bed? And then I was forced to think, I could actually laugh out loud at the cheekiness and the ingenuity of this tiny, tiny little bird. So that's what I did, I laughed out loud. And I thought, what more joy could eating these strawberries give me than what I've just seen? Absolutely gorgeous little thing as he, and honestly, it felt like he was. Anyway, laws of gleaning. Go back to what we're doing. The laws of gleaning. So that's the first thing. And, you know, we can practice that in our everyday life today. You know, it's not just about the things we grow. It's about learning the value of enough. When is it I've had sufficient? And what is it... can we find ways in everyday life of living generously out of our plenty? So, just hearing the coffee being made there, throw a couple of dollars behind the till for the next person coming along, so that out of our plenty, somebody else benefits as well, and it becomes a practice of life. The second social security institution that's present in this Book of Ruth is these laws of inheritance and the kinsman redeemer, or guardian redeemer as it's called here. The nearest male relative, if a farmer was lazy or just a bad farmer or just had a bad season and he got into debt And the only way to expunge that debt is to sell the land. But when you sell the land in this culture, you are also selling on something of the blessing of God. Because the presence of God in this culture is a really tangible thing. It literally is the ground beneath your feet. This belief that God has given us the land, and he has apportioned it to every tribe, and apportioned it then to every family. So when I want to know whether I have a connection with God, all I have to do is walk out into my field. And the presence of God is as tangible as the ground beneath my feet. So if I have to sell my land, I am, in a sense, selling my portion of the blessing of God. I'm losing my connection with God. Which is why the conquest and the exile was such an awful thing, because they were literally uprooted out of the presence of God and brought somewhere else. So there were protections put in for that bad season, or for that poor farmer, that the oldest male relative in the family could step in and buy the land from whoever he had to sell it to, and hold that land in trust almost for the family. And it meant that not just that individual family, but the wider family circle didn't lose that real physical connection. So the surprise comes when we learn in the text that Naomi has a little piece of land still as a kind of nest egg held away, but things are so bad she has to sell this land. And Boaz is stepping up to Boaz is stepping up either by himself or there is a closer relative who is this other guy. He's not named in the text. In Jewish tradition, he's known as Tob or Tob. And that's just a tradition. And he doesn't have a good reputation because he didn't step up and do what a kinsman redeemer, what a guardian redeemer should do. So there's another way in which poor people are protected. And the third way, and this is where we're getting into today, as well, the third thing is a form of marriage called levirate marriage. And this sounds odd in our ears today, but the law stipulated that a deceased husband's brother, or even the deceased husband's father, should marry the widow in order to have a child who could inherit the land from his deceased father. So it was a requirement of the family that the family should find a male relative to marry the widow. Now, this can't apply to Naomi because we know from the story Naomi is too old to have children now. So levirate marriage is of no use to Naomi because she can't have kids. And so whoever buys the land, and we'll see how this, whoever buys the land to hold it for her will end up owning it because there's no way it can pass back to Naomi's family. Unless they could find generosity in themselves as a community to treat Ruth as if she was one of them. Now, this is no small thing, because she is a Moabite. As they keep on reminding us, and they keep on telling us in the text. So what we have at play here are these three laws or rules intermingling. And the question is, how are we going to treat Ruth? Boaz has already decided, I'll treat her as family. I may even marry her, we might even have kids, but the kid will never inherit the land because he's not one of us. So anyway, Boaz strategically places himself at a prominent place in the town. I love this. Just as the closer relative comes walking by, Boaz says, come over here, my friend. And sit down so you just know you're being set up for something. So he went over and he sat down. Boaz took 10 elders of the town and said, sit here. So the elders sit there and he sits with his friend, his relative, and they have a conversation. He says to the guardian redeemer, Naomi, who has come back from Moab, is selling the piece of land that belonged to our relative Elimelech. I thought I should bring the matter to your attention and suggest that you buy it in the presence of those seated here and in the presence of the elders of my people. So the guy now knows this has been prepared in advance. There's something serious going on here. Piece of land. This is a big decision to be made. If you will redeem it, do so. But if you will not, tell me so I will know. For no one has the right to do it except you, and I'm the next in line. So the guy says, chance to buy a piece of land. Naomi can't have kids. It'll be added into my stock of land. It'll increase my wealth. I will redeem it. Of course I'll redeem it. So Boaz has set him up. That clear enough? Want to move on? Yeah. Any comments?
And has Boaz set him up, or is Boaz looking to get the land and getting rid of the next in line?
Boaz has set him up, and for precisely that reason, but we'll see how he does it now in a moment. Yes, Chad.
Just trying to understand. So this land was never mentioned before.
No.
So as a woman, did she not have any means to use it to support herself and Ruth? And did she not have any means to sell it herself?
There's only her and Ruth, so the working of the land would be very difficult for the two women. A woman, in certain circumstances, it was not unknown for a woman to inherit the land. Usually, if there is only a daughter, for instance, and there are no sons, the oldest daughter could inherit land in certain circumstances. So that seems to be what has happened here. The two daughters-in-law, of course, wouldn't inherit it because they were Moabites, as we keep on saying. So let's keep moving here. Then Boaz said, oh, here, by the way, I forgot to tell you. On the day you buy the land from Naomi, you also, and, you know, we've got to face up to the language they're using here, but it's a different culture. On the day you buy the land from Naomi, you also acquire Ruth the Moabite. This is the first time for quite a while in the story that, and I think he does this deliberately to kind of say, by the way, you do know she's a Moabite. Ruth the Moabite. On the day you buy the land from Naomi, you also acquire Ruth the Moabite, the dead man's widow, in order to maintain the name of the dead with his property. Now, a couple of things here. One is, no. I mean, if I did take her into my house, into my home, as a kind of wife, I'm not required to marry her because she's a Moabite. And if she did have a child, there's no way he would inherit the land because he'd be the child of a Moabite woman. She's not one of us. However, it does get complicated, and he realizes this. At this, the guardian redeemer takes a breath in through his teeth. Ooh, I can't redeem it because I might endanger my own estate. There is the possibility, you see, if I did marry her to get the land, and she did have a child, that child, I do not consider that child would be one of us. He would be the oldest son. He would inherit the land. Now, what would happen if with my other wife, who is one of us, what would happen if we didn't have children? All my land, the risk is that all my land would go to the son of a foreigner. So God's land would move out of the possession of God's people into the hands of a foreigner, I'm not really prepared to take that risk. Because I don't consider her to be one of us. Now, in earlier times, a little bit of explanation from the author kind of interrupts the flow of the story, but it's necessary. I cannot redeem it because I might endanger my own estate. You do it yourself. I don't care, in one sense, how you treat, what you consider her to be. To me, she's a foreigner. You do it. You redeem it yourself. I can't do it. Now, in earlier times in Israel, for the redemption and transfer of property to become final, one party took off his sandal and gave it to another. You can actually read about those instructions in the Bible. And this was the method of legalizing transactions in Israel. So you hand your sandal over to the person. And it was actually quite a shameful thing to do, because in handing over the sandal, you were saying, I'm not prepared to live up to my responsibilities. And so elsewhere in the law, it says the person who did this, not just him, but his whole family, became known as the family of the unsandaled. So this becomes a kind of nickname, almost it's a bad reputation that follows a family through the generations.
Wait, that's just if they sell their land, not other
people. If they want to find, like, I'm not prepared to do this, I'm giving over responsibility for this land to you in the form of the sandal. So it's really, you know, well, there's lots of tradition in relation to sandals and taking sandals off, but I'm passing responsibility to you. I'm passing over the benefit of the land to you and to acquire.
So he'd be the sole owner.
You're the sole owner. I'm not gonna compete with bad puns like that. I have too much self-respect to bad jokes like that. Oh, I just lower the tone of the conversation.
We'll go on ruthlessly.
Yes, ruthlessly exploiting any options. So the guardian redeemer said to Boaz, buy it yourself, and he removed the sandal. Then Boaz announced to the, and this is now the sort of dramatic heart of the story, although it doesn't look like it. Most people think chapter 3 is the dramatic heart, and it is in one sense, but this is the point. Boaz announced to the elders and all the people, today all of you, all the people of the town, all the elders of the town, you are witnesses that I have bought from Naomi all the property of Elimelech, Kilian, and Mahlon. I've also acquired Ruth the Moabite, Mahlon's widow, as my wife. And I'm doing this in order to maintain the name of the dead with his property, so that his name will not disappear from among his family or from his hometown. Today you are witnesses. And so he essentially, this is the public policy part of this, he pushes this out to them and he said, I'm going to buy this land and I'm going to marry this woman, and I'm doing this, both of these things, so that any children that we have together will inherit this land as one of us. Now I'm requiring you to be witnesses of this. This is the point at which Boaz's personal recognition of Ruth as family and kin is now being taken up to the level of public policy to say, are we all ready to buy into this? Are we all ready to be witnesses to this? Are we all going to treat her no longer as Ruth the Moabite, but Ruth, who's one of us? Then the elders and all the people at the gate said, yeah. Yeah, we're going to do that. We're witnesses. May the Lord make the woman who is coming into your home like Rachel and Leah, who together built up the family of Israel. Now think about this for a moment. Look, this is, I find this incredibly moving. Take this foreigner and make her, treat her like one of the matriarchs of the nation. Like Rachel and Leah, who together built up the family of Israel. And may you have standing in Ephrathah because of your wisdom and kindness and generosity, Boaz. May you have standing in Ephrathah, Bethlehem, and be famous in Bethlehem. Through the offspring the Lord gives you by this young woman, may your family be like that of Perez, whom Tamar bore to Judah. Now, just as an aside, if you want another salacious story of bizarre marriage rituals, read the story of Tamar and Judah. That's for another week at Holden. But what he's saying here is, we are, even though she's a Moabite, and that hasn't changed, we are going to open membership of this community to a foreign presence.
What if she was Palestinian?
In the sense, well, I mean, do you mean in contemporary sense?
Sort of.
Why would that, why do you ask the question? Kind of open up the question.
Would they be as willing to accept someone from Palestinian to, and become as a matriarch of the Israeli
people? That's a question for contemporary present day Israel. Who are the Moabites in America? Who are the Moabites in Northern Ireland? And actually the question changes depending on where you ask. Because most nations of the world have people they consider who could never be part of us. Or we have closed the door of membership to people like that. Or the means of becoming a member of this nation is so difficult that we effectively keep them outside. But this is, like, I genuinely, here's the confession. I'm in terms of the theology I do, it tends to be in Hebrew Bible or Old Testament. And so I have a reasonable grasp of the stories of the Old Testament. Like, we stumbled, when the team were sitting down to prepare these resources, all I knew about the book of Ruth was there were border crossings. So I thought borders, it might be useful to have a little story. I've worked with this story now for about a year and a half, maybe 2 years. And for just over a year in these kinds of workshops. I am convinced that this is the most radical book in the Bible. This is a lot more than a romantic love story. I don't think it ever was a romantic love story, but I think this is the most radical and challenging book because it asks us to ask questions about how you belong. Are there ways of belonging to us that are deeper than just a blood belonging? Or just a question about where you were born? How does somebody become part of us? And that's why I asked you at the very beginning, in your setting here, what are the privileges of being part of America? And what are the responsibilities that come? And I know something of the deeply complicated history, and of asking a question like that to an audience like this, I'm deeply conscious of the voices that are not in this room, for whom a question of belonging to this land is not just one about the length of time they've been here, but of how their belonging was taken away. So what does it mean to belong? What are the rights and the privileges, but also the responsibilities that accompany it? Yes, Judy.
As you say that, I am struck about why the elders agreed.
Yeah.
Was Boaz that respected, powerful, whatever you want to call it, but that the elders agreed, or did Boaz set it up so they didn't really have a choice?
I'll give you an answer to that in a moment. What's your instinct in terms of why the elders agreed? Now, I should say, there are complexities about this belonging and about what they do here. I'm not so much interested in raising the practice here to a principle of this is the way it should be done. I'm not looking to raise the exact way they do this as the, because I think there's a part of why they were willing to do this is connected to the character and the good, loyal kindness and good character of Ruth.
Okay.
So I think it's very difficult for the people, having seen how she has treated one of their own, they are prepared to extend. There are complications about that. If we elevated that to a principle, there are complications to that about how we deal with the borders here or back home. I'm more interested in the fact that this happened, that they were able to address tradition in this particular way. I'm going to come back to that in a moment. So Boaz, I feel the need to state it again. Like, they have overthrown maybe hundreds of years of tradition in that first paragraph. So Boaz took Ruth and she became his wife. When he made love to her, the Lord enabled her to conceive, and she gave birth to a son. In the Hebrew, this is really interesting. Because there is a Hebrew word that is used regularly for conception. This is not it. This word is one in which, my apologies if this offends, in which somehow the Lord makes this happen, that Ruth wasn't overly interested in having children. And this is not the word used for a normal conception between a couple. The Lord, the force of the language, the punch of the language is he forced this conception upon her. The Lord enabled her to conceive, and she gave birth to a son. Look what happens here. This is like, this is so, this close, a close reading of this is so interesting. The women said to Naomi, "Praise be to the Lord who this day has not left you without a guardian redeemer." The infant now becomes the guardian redeemer for Naomi. "May he become famous throughout Israel. He will renew your life and sustain you in your old age." I bet some of you have experienced that. I know my wife's dad, who passed away 5 or 6 years ago, when he was in his late 70s, he experienced the first serious illness of his life. Incredibly robust man, and he became ill, and this completely knocked his confidence. And for months and months and months after that, we just saw him decline, and we thought he wouldn't make 80. And then my sister-in-law came pregnant, gave birth to a baby boy, and Andrew renewed my father-in-law's life. And he lived till he was 93. So we know what that's like, I'm sure.
Excuse me, Glenn?
Yes.
Would you mind, there's some paradox here. So whatever Hebrew word it was translated, made love to her. And then there's a consonant, some meaning of being forced to conceive. So how are those things don't sound the same to me?
No. I mean, she became pregnant in the normal way that this happens. But the word used for the conception is not the normal, regular Hebrew word used in the Bible text. It's a slightly unusual word, and I think it might become a little bit clearer as we go. But we're reading, or we're trying to imaginatively enter into this story to try and understand Ruth a little bit more and understand her story.
Not sure why it's important, but what's the difference between her laying down on the threshing floor, that was very coy, but we know what happened, and make love to?
Yeah.
I guess that's what I'm getting at.
Well, this is the legal.
Gotcha.
This is legal. Because they're now married.
Yeah. Fair enough.
You know,
and that would be a different word.
It would be a different word. Gotcha. But the challenge is this here, is what does it mean in the Hebrew, the Lord enabled her? As I said, there is a background to that word that has a kind of... I think it might become a little bit clearer as we read on. For your daughter-in-law who loves you and who is better to you than seven sons. I love this. There's a difference in value systems in the two women here. All Naomi wanted was a boy. And the birth of this child renewed her life, sustains her. This Naomi is part of this, she is part of this older, traditional, this is what she wanted, to preserve the name of her husband, to preserve the name of her two sons, and it has happened, and as far as she's concerned, life is complete. We have completed this circle. But the women also remind her, don't you forget, see the woman who came back from Moab with you? She's worth more to you than seven sons. Isn't that gorgeous?
Yeah.
Don't forget, because you remember when they first, in chapter one, when they first arrived at the gates of Jerusalem, and there's the whole place is stirred, and can this really be Naomi? And she says, don't call me Naomi. Call me Mara, which means bitter. I'm bitter because I went away with plenty and I've returned with nothing. And Ruth is standing behind saying, what about me? I came. I have stuck by you. So the women, and I think something of the joy of the women in this here is also a recognition for the women in the town that there are new social protections for women now that weren't there before. But don't forget the value of Ruth to you.
Is this public change? Because for me it sounds much, they still hate Moabites in general. This one particular person, they have opened their hearts to, like we do in communities, right? Well, this person is the nicest person of color you've ever known. Or this lesbian is part of our community because we love her in particular. But it doesn't extend to general.
What a great question. Did everybody hear that?
Yeah.
Is this a change? Well, do you know what? I think this is the beginning of a change. The strap line, the mission statement for the organization I work for, we are deeply committed to a mission which is transforming division through human encounter. It's why we began in our first session last, way back, like years ago on Monday, with a look at the practice of stereotyping. And stereotyping is a way in which we can turn our back on an individual story and apply usually a negative story to a whole group. And when I do that, I don't have to engage with any individuals because I know what they're all like. So all you people upstairs, none of you want to participate in the community down here. So that's why you all are up there, because you're all, you know, loners, you're all, you know, and you don't like people and conversation because you're all like that. And then one of you comes and sits beside me at lunch and we have a conversation and I am hugely entertained, and I've got to say, maybe you just slept in this morning. Maybe breakfast was late, or maybe... It's very difficult for a stereotype of a people to survive a genuine encounter with an individual.
But any time you can put a face on it, you're making another little step.
Yeah, every time you put a face on it, you're making a step towards... I undoubtedly there will still be, because the history with Moabites, that's hundreds of years of. But you know what? I've met a Moabite who defied my stereotype. That opens the door to the possibility that there might be another person from there, and another person. And Naomi took the child in her arms and cared for him. Isn't that unusual too? Like, it's Ruth. Actually, Ruth has disappeared from the story now.
Yeah.
Ruth's job was done when she gave birth to the boy. Now we're back into the traditional line of things. The women living there said, Naomi has a son. Naomi needed the son. Ruth gave her the son. Now, there are at least two ways of coming at this, and I don't know which is the right answer. I guess it depends on our experience, and I'm conscious of reading this story as a man. Ruth disappears from the story. Is this because they pushed her aside? That's entirely possible. It's also just possible to come back to the issue about God enabling her, or God enabling her to conceive. It might be the fact that Ruth in her generosity recognized that Naomi needed the boy more than Ruth needed him. And therefore, there's just the possibility that there's a degree of agency here on Ruth's part. I have done what your tradition requires. Now, I don't need to be part of the drama of your lives anymore. I'm stepping out of this story now. I've got other things to do with my life that don't depend upon the men in my life. There's a really interesting thing, which I didn't point out in the story, just back here. Yes, I've also acquired Ruth the Moabite, Mahlon's widow. Everywhere in the story, the order is this: Kilian and Mahlon. And right back to chapter 1, the way the women are named, the assumption is that Ruth is married to Kilian and Orpah is married to Mahlon. This is the first time we realize, ooh, she's Mahlon's widow. Didn't know that. It's not clear in the story. And it might be just a literary technique to say, Ruth was never dependent upon the men in her life. She was never shaped by the requirements of the men in her life. There was always this degree of independence and agency that she had that did not rest in the power of the men in her life. And so it's just possible that her disappearance from the story is her choice. But either way, what we've got then is this amazing thing that Naomi has a son. They named him Obed. He was the father of Jesse, the father of David. And of course, then the men take over the story, and the men do all the begatting in what follows. But let's not lose sight of the fact that by the time we get to hear the great King David, we realize he's got mixed blood. There's a foreigner, even in the kingly royal line of the nation.
Hasn't Boaz also challenged those 10 men and the others to never say, send her back to Moab?
Yeah.
You've redeemed yourself.
Yeah, and you're back in the club. Yeah, I mean, it is extraordinary. And one other thing to notice, what is Boaz's intention? Up here in verse 5, the day you will also acquire Ruth the Moabite, the dead man's widow, in order to maintain the name of the dead with his property. Where is he? Sorry, come back to him a moment. Where is he? Where's Malon? Malon's gone.
Yeah.
So that forces us to ask, why is he there? Because he marries Ruth to have a son to protect and preserve Malon's name, but it's Boaz that gets in the list of the kingly line. Now, there's no right answer to this, but it invites speculation, it invites imagination. And is it because this list is preserving for us also the kind of generous actions of ancestors that we must never lose? That yes, there are stories in our history that perhaps we regret or are ashamed of, but there are also those in our story, in our history, whose actions continue to inspire us. These are the stories we need to remember. And there are certain times in our history where we need to recall them again, keep them before us. We are capable of better things.
Okay. I'm thinking about on Monday when we talked about the liturgical connection between, you know, reading the law and then partnering up with the story. It's my understanding, reading through the book, that, you know, God is not directly active in the book. God doesn't do things. God's name, the Lord's name, shows up primarily as a method of blessing, but it's other people who do the activity of God. You know, if God's going to be active in the story, it's people doing that for each other. So then the one place where the Lord is directly active is in that conception of the child. And I'm wondering if part of the reason for that is to make it super clear that God thinks this thing is a good idea.
Right. This is
and
right. Brilliant.
Like the one thing God does is make sure Ruth has a baby. And kind of a bummer if Ruth didn't really want that, but the point is that that God wants to be clear that this story is good and right, and what has been done here is right. And I think that's an important balance for reading that big law with big God and then having God be in that like small moment.
Brilliant, brilliant. That's why I love doing this in groups like this, because we, you know, I've picked up, I make notes along the way, I make notes after these things of the things I've learned in these sessions, and that's great. We're running out of time. Quickly, I'm not going to spend too much time on this, but this is worthy of a whole other conversation. Ruth is redeemed as the other. There is no requirement on Ruth to pass a citizenship test. There is no evidence in the story that Ruth converts to Judaism. As I said again right at the beginning on Monday or Tuesday, that Ruth's primary loyalty, you know, that great statement of, you know, your people will be my people, your God will be my God, where you are buried, I'll be buried, and so on. Her primary loyalty is to her mother-in-law, not to God. She only commits to God, because of her loyalty first to Naomi. And she is consistently referred to as the Moabite until Boaz begins to change the language and makes it family language. She is redeemed. She is invited in as the other. So this challenging, troubling, foreign, feminine presence is folded into the family without the requirement to become one of us. Next, again, this is me flagging up stuff that none of you, or very few of you, have any part of, but one of the interesting things in the story of the Good Samaritan, about the story of what it is to be a neighbor, and you've got the two groups of people, the principle Jesus appears to teach is that when it comes to being a neighbor, of acting as a neighbor towards somebody on the outside, it is not that we say, well, here's our club here, and we'll let you come in. The gospel act of being a neighbor is to say, hey, we want you to be part, and we'll come over here and fold you in. Not so that it's we that make the change. The ones with the power and the privilege make the change to fold the vulnerable in, to fold those at the margins of our community in. And Ruth is embraced as the other, always as the other. And this to me is the radical point of this story. What has happened in that paragraph, I said, when the community eventually agrees to do what Boaz suggests, is that they take this precious, hundreds of years old law of Moses, like Moses. Let me say it again. Moses' law. And they say, do you know, in the face of the circumstances we've got here now, we need to change Moses' law. Now think about this for a minute. Moses said, we mentioned it again earlier in the week, like, you can let the Egyptians in, you can let the Moabites, the Edomites in, but never, ever, ever let a Moabite. And that's because of the sting of their experience with Moabites on their journey through the wilderness, and how the Moabites refused hospitality, and it stings. And in those early memories and the shaping of the law, it couldn't conceive a possibility of a good, kind Moabite. Just didn't exist. They'd never experienced it. And here they are several hundred years later, and the world is changing, and people are changing, and borders are changing. And here's a good Moabite. Here's a kind, loyal, loving Moabite. The law never conceived of this. So people of Bethlehem, we've got a choice. We stick with the law, and we say, look, Ruth, we really do love you here, and we're glad you're here, but you know what? We just kind of shrug our shoulders. The law says. Or in the face of this thing that we've never experienced before, this person we've never experienced before, the law never intended to exclude. You remember, again, to go back to the liturgical idea of Ruth, as the kindness in the story of Ruth is the proper lens through which to view the law. The purpose of the law of Moses, funnily enough and strangely enough, is to increase the store of kindness in the world. That's what the law is there, to regulate our unkindnesses to one another. So the purpose of the law is to increase the store of kindness. And what the people in Bethlehem, under Boaz's guidance, realize, that if the application of a law results in an unintended or unforeseen unkindness, then the law needs to be changed. And what we have in the story of Ruth is an example from within the Bible itself, of the Bible radically reinterpreting itself in new times, new eras. Now, some people say, yeah, but where does that end? Exactly. Where does that end? Take the text, live with that text, and if live always for the intent of the law to increase kindness, and if the application of the law results in unkindness, go for the intent, change the law to include. Whether that's the people on our borders, whether that's back home and it's the question of Brexiteers and Remainers and the European Union, or Protestants and Catholics in Northern Ireland, whether it's on issues of race, as we've been talking about extensively this week, whether it's to do with LGBTQI inclusion, if the application of law results in unkindness and exclusion, the law needs to be changed. And the Bible gives us permission to do it. Even the law of Moses. I'm nearly done. I'm going to go. Again, I always get to these last few slides that we never get a chance to talk about, but that would have been an interesting question. Maybe it's one you can carry with you down the lake over the next couple of days. But a couple of things just for me to say. As we engage in difficult conversations and difficult relationship and strained politics, remember that one day we're going to have to walk back from the things we've said about one another, otherwise we're locked in conflict forever. So, in the light of that, we need to pay attention to our language about one another, particularly across lines of difference, so that the distance we have to walk back is not as far. So the distance we're walking back is maybe a walk out to 10 Mile Falls rather than a walk up to Elon Musk's switchbacks. Do you know, in terms of encountering people rather than issues and movements, maybe consume other news outlets and other news sources just to balance the ones we go to hear different stories about how our politics is being experienced and our conflict is being experienced. Practice attention, notice the things that are being noticed and the things that are not being noticed. Learn to pay attention, practice attention. And I think there is a transformational power in acts of kindness. And there's an infectiousness about kindness that pulls the best out of us. Practice kindness. And I want to finish two things. I want a song and then a closing prayer. So it's not going to take too long. We're way over time. But thank you for your patience. Again, there's a local guy. We listened to him on the one day during the week. But let this song roll over you as a prayer. And then when this song is finished, I will say a prayer. And then... And then we're dismissed.
She came in from the cold, dropped her luggage bags, looked the concierge in the eye, said I need a room for the night, but I don't got no money, would you take bail in kind? He said, it's all right, and I will be able to share mine. Make the bed in the morning, and I'll do fine. You can change in the bathroom, hang your clothes on the line. A tear came to her eyes, she thought, how could he be so kind? How could he be so kind? How could he be so kind? She sat down on the bed with a knee, and he said, I need to see you bleed. Just fetch a warm towel and sit with you till you're dry. She started to cry, saying, why? Consider it a little discriminating act of kindness. Consider it a little discriminating act of kindness. Consider it a little discriminating act of kindness. kindness. She was cold turkey, he was cold at her heart. She said, I was ruined by mine. This was never in my plans. I dreamed of men who loved me, together would see the world. Somehow I lost myself among the insults they heard. I'm sure you're right for long. And someday there will surely be someone. So just relax, man. It's important that you come. She said, how is it you can see past me as I am? Consider it an indiscriminate act of kindness. Consider it an indiscriminate act of kindness. Consider it an indiscriminate act of kindness. When you took your chances, it was like you placed a bet. And sometimes this is the reward you can get. And I was always told, if you see someone defiled, you should look them in the eye and smile. Take their heart of innocence, take them home, home, home.
In these days of incivility, so much of our talk to one another is hard. Talk of breaks and splits and broken relationships, of uncomfortable apology and fumbled sympathies. Even words which should be soft aren't. Our union is disunited. Our community is coarsened. And I confess that it's hard to rejoice in the richness of your blessing if my enemy isn't impoverished at the same time. I confess it's difficult to celebrate my freedom won in Christ if my opponent isn't permanently disadvantaged. So forgive me if my face is flushed with anger and the hand of my friendship is twisted into a cold fist of opposition. So I pray, bring comfort to troubled spirits whose futures are uncertain. Bring peace to conflicted hearts whose loyalties are torn. bring wisdom to confused minds whose decisions are momentous. Teach all of us kindness and generosity in this time of discourtesy. Guide us in how to enjoy the liberating work of Jesus without the need to see God's vengeance worked on others. For the sake of our witness to you, for the sake of our neighbors, for my sake. Amen. All the resources on the Book of Ruth that we've produced are available online. This is it here. Free to download off the website and use. I'd be delighted for you to use it and to let me know, if possible, how that worked for you. Secondly, a resource on conflict. You can sign up at spiritualityofconflict.com and for lectionary resources on the gospel text each week. And then staying in contact with Coramila, our organization on Twitter, if you're a person who uses Twitter. Crooked Shore is me, and for nonsense and photographs of my dogs and other stuff, but would be delighted to keep in contact. So thank you, and my apologies for keeping you so late.